Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor at Guymere Baptist Church. And for the next half hour or so, your host, as we unpack three questions from Sunday's message. On last Sunday, we jumped back into Romans. And I do mean jumped back because we are going through Romans backwards. This is based on a book by a scholar named Scott McKnight, who argues that we need to read the book of Romans backwards in order to keep in the forefront of our minds the way in which the letter ends, because it is the ending of the letter, the pastoral exhortations that Paul makes to what appears to be a bit of a fractured Roman church. It's that pastoral setting that drives his doctrinal introduction. Too often with the book of Romans, this will come up in at least one of the questions today, too often in Romans, the first part of Romans 1 through 8 in particular are treated a little bit like abstract theology, as if Paul were writing an overview of what he believed about the gospel. And then the second part kind of has some exhortations to it, and that's kind of all there is to it. In order to keep the end in mind, we've decided to go backwards. And so earlier in the year, we went through chapters 12 through 16, and we did move actually backwards through that, started in chapter 16 and moving back. Now we're in chapters 9 through 11. We're going to do that in order because it's an ordered argument. There are no kind of subsections that are, I mean, Paul's sections are always related to each other, but there's a continuity of argument that we really need to pay attention to here. So we will be doing that in order. And we began by looking at Romans chapter 9, verses 1 to 29, going with the NIV UK headings, as Paul turns his attention to the people of Israel. And why some or most Israelites had rejected Jesus as their Messiah, and why the Gentiles had been included and what that meant. And again, it's pretty important to keep the end in mind that Paul is still addressing a pastoral situation and a pastoral concern. So it's going to take us 4 weeks as a community of faith to work our way through these three chapters. And hopefully by the end of it, we'll have a much better feel, not only for what is to come, right? The passages that we've already looked at, right? Kind of help us make some sense of those, but also kind of a bit of a foreshadowing of what we're going to encounter in the first eight chapters, because this provides a bit of a transition from that doctrinal foundation to the ethical exhortations. So that's where we're up to. That's what we're trying to do. And here are the questions. So the first one is this: if this section isn't about predestination, why is it so often used this way? So I made the point that this passage is related to Paul's concerns about the relational fractures between Jewish and Gentile believers, and that his primary concern is who are the people of God, not who is saved. And so the idea of predestination, while there is language of election and choice, and that election and choice of God is apart from anything that we do, is often used or referred to in the wider conversations around predestination. This is not it, right? So if it's not about predestination, why is it so often used that way? Secondly, how are personal salvation and inclusion in the people of God related? So it's not, I don't think the passage is about personal salvation, but personal salvation, of course, is part of the big story of being the people of God. One of the ways you could identify the people of God is those who have been saved. So they are related, and so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the third question is this: would the Gentiles have understood all the Old Testament references? Why would Paul use so many if they wouldn't have? did draw attention to the fact that this passage, this section, chapters 9, 10, and 11, contain up to a third of all of Paul's Old Testament references that you could find in all of his writings. So there is a concentration of them here that is quite extraordinary. And if he is writing to a group of Jews and Gentiles, well, then what's with the 900 references to the Old Testament and the constant allusions to these texts that the Gentiles may not have been as familiar with? So it's a good question to grapple again with what Paul is doing and how he is going about doing this. So let's jump in. If this section isn't about predestination, why is it so often used this way? The one of the reasons why I have often been hesitant in the past to preach Romans is because of the usual way that it's read, that it's some kind of overview and outline of Paul's theology. And it just felt dry to me, just felt like a dry doctrinal thing. McKnight's idea that we needed to read it backwards to keep the pastoral context in mind has really reinvigorated my understanding of Romans, but also my engagement with Romans, because what it invites me to do is whenever there are passages that appear to just be really dense theology, I'm invited to ask the question, how would a Jewish believer or a Gentile believer have heard this in the Roman context? And so that's helped me think sort of from an application perspective about theology. And good theology ought to be applicable. How we think about God intersects real life. That's good theology, right? Those two things. Good thinking about God intersecting our real life. And so that's helpful. But because of the dominant way in which the book has been read, I think that's ultimately the reason why these passages have often been linked with predestination. Paul is talking about the people of Israel, but he weaves in components of Gentiles as well. And because the first part of Romans is often abstracted from its original context, where the implications or the application of Romans 1 through 8 is its personal application to me, then I can end up looking at statements that Paul makes around election and God's sovereign choice and how that is apart from anything that I have done, whether good or bad, as in the example of Jacob and Esau. And so it just ends up sliding into personal salvation. I think it's also important to note that since the Reformation in the 16th century, sorry, in the 15th century and beyond, there has been a strong emphasis on what might be called, what can be called, Reformed theology. So you may be familiar with the name John Calvin, the reforming Frenchman who ended up doing a whole bunch of really significant theological work. And for Calvin, his theology, as I understand it, is really focused on the sovereignty of God. And so he has become, his theology has become synonymous with predestination, the idea that God has elected some to salvation, and therefore that God has also elected some not to salvation, but to judgment. And that choice has been made by God, and there's nothing that we can do about it. And Paul is not a Calvinist, for obvious reasons, but that has been a really, really dominant stream of Protestant theology. And while there are voices that would be opposed to Calvin or would have a mediating position between, you know, our absolute free will and God's absolute sovereign choice, essentially, that's been a really dominant strand of Protestant theology. Very, very common. And because of its common features and because of the significance of Romans, really, in the Reformation. So Martin Luther, the German reformer, who and it was the 16th century, now that I think about it. The German reformer, one of his most striking theological realizations was out of Romans, all right? That the righteous shall live by faith. And prior to his insight, he had seen that as you must be righteous, and if you are righteous, then you can live by faith, which put a great deal of emphasis on works and merit and all those sorts of things. And he realized that it is actually the faith that makes one righteous. And that insight really, really drove the Reformation. So you may have heard of things like, faith alone, the scriptures alone, those sorts of things. That comes out of the Reformation. So for Luther, personal salvation was really tied up with Romans. You have Calvin and the emphasis on predestination. And the impact of Romans goes beyond that, of course. It's not as if it's an unimportant book. There's a reason why it's listed first amongst Paul's letters, right? It's a really significant letter. So I think, broadly speaking, apart from the history lesson, the reason that it's used to talk about predestination so often is because of the Protestant heritage and the tendency to abstract the theology from its pastoral context into an individual one. Therefore, when we read these passages, we immediately seek to apply them in our individual lives, rather than trying to make sense of them in the context of the body of Christ. So I think that's a pretty important place to start. And it's, again, why we're preaching Romans backwards. It's an opportunity for us to keep that pastoral context in mind in order to shape our own applications to it and to make some sense of it as well. So I think that's why it's used that way more commonly. And it's a fairly intense section of scripture as well, which is probably worth noting as well. Second question is, how are personal salvation and inclusion in the people of God related? So again, on Sunday, stated this is not about predestination. This is not about individual salvation per se. And when you read it through, it doesn't talk about forgiveness. It doesn't talk about salvation. It talks about God's choice of who his people are. So when it talks about the examples of Abraham and of Isaac, of Abraham's two sons and Isaac's two sons, or Isaac and Rebekah's two sons, as the text kind of makes it quite clear, the emphasis is not on who gets saved, but who are the people of God, the people of the promise, those who've been shown mercy, those sorts of things. So the question of salvation, of forgiveness, of redemption, of atonement, of all those sorts of things is absent from at least this first section of Romans 9 to 11. So, I think that we need to keep that solidly in mind. And I think that, of course, fits really neatly, as I was saying in the answer to the first question, with the pastoral context, right? This is written to a group of people, who were probably diverse in lots of ways, right? Male and female, slave and free. Even those who were free, probably there was a fair degree of gaps in their socioeconomic standing. Those who owned houses that churches could meet in, and those who certainly would not have. And then, of course, on top of all of that, you had the divide or the fault line of the Jewish believers and the Gentile believers, which is the most significant of them here. And so the question of who are the people of God fits, well, it drives nicely to that outcome, right? Paul is driving towards how Jews and Gentiles ought to eat meals together and welcome one another and, right, all that kind of stuff. And so it makes sense that he would be focused not on who gets saved, but on who are the people of God. However, as I said at the very beginning, one of the characteristics of the people of God, of course, is that we are those who have been saved. So salvation is not has not been set aside here, but it has been placed, shall we say, under a higher category, right? Who are the people of God? Becomes the highest category of organization. And then underneath that come a bunch of other subcategories, right? Of which salvation will be one. It's not the focus here. Here it's on God's sovereignty. It's on God's choice. It's on God's mercy. And on our reactions and responses to that. And so I think we need to see those two things as being related to each other, where Paul makes the relationship to them. So, you know, Paul does talk about, you know, the people of Israel having been elected, right? According to God's purposes. And I think even that language is really important because it pushes salvation down one more level. And I've said this before, God's purpose for us is not just that we be forgiven, as if that were the ultimate aim, the ultimate goal. That once you and I had accepted Jesus and by faith had been forgiven and washed clean of all the guilt, that was kind of the end game for God. That's not the end game for God. His plans and purposes, as outlined from the very beginning of Scripture, are to fill the world with his order and with his rule and with his character and with his image bearers to complete the work and bring glory to him, right? That's what God's purposes are. And so when sin entered the world, sin had to be dealt with in order that the people of God could fulfill their purposes that God had given to them to restore and renew all things and to participate in that. So God's sovereignty, right, and, you know, God's choice of who his people are sits above, in this context, his purposes, or maybe his purposes sit above his selection, right? But it's the idea that God has these big purposes to restore and renew all things. He chooses who his people are, and those people are saved. They're shown mercy, right? That's where the connection point lies, right? We know that we've been shown mercy, and that, well, we don't yet because we haven't read chapters 1 through 8. But if you read ahead or read behind in anticipation, you'll find, right? Like we know, right? We know that part of being shown mercy is the idea that we have forgiveness and eternal life and all the things that we so often talk about. So I'm not suggesting that we forget those things or set them aside or say that they're not important. What I'm hopefully arguing, and that's probably too strong a word, but what I'm hopefully presenting is we really need to read Romans, for instance, and Romans 9 to 11 and allow them to speak apart from all of Paul's other letters. We just need to allow Paul's letter to the Romans speak as clearly as we can allow it to, right? There's a time and a place to compare what Paul says with Romans with what he says in Galatians, for instance, about salvation. And there's times and places for us to consider, you know, the letters that he writes to the Philippians or to the Corinthians and consider how there's overlap and where he expands on particular ideas differently and all those sorts of things. But ultimately, we just need to let Romans speak by itself. And speak into the pastoral setting that it is focused upon. So personal salvation, I should say that as well, that there was a much stronger corporate sense of salvation in the Old Testament and the New Testament than we have now. We have a very individualized experience and expression of salvation. It's quite typical of Protestant theology, more generally, where it's our encounter with Jesus that becomes so important, as opposed to, say, like a Roman Catholic theology where our salvation is found in the church, right? Like we are, by becoming part of the church, that's where we gain salvation. It's very different. It's more of a corporate view. In biblical times, the more corporate view was far stronger in that sense. And so again, Paul, I don't think even if he were talking about salvation, the language, he wouldn't necessarily be thinking about individual people, although he could, right? He could speak about himself as having been, you know, saved. He could speak of himself as having been forgiven. He could speak of his own relationship with Jesus. But his conceptions were often quite broader than that. So I think personal salvation and the inclusion of the people of God are related for a bunch of reasons in the text. But we do need to just allow Romans to speak for Romans, allow Paul to address the pastoral concern that he has there and not get too fussed or carried away with bringing in everything else that Paul has to say and mushing it into Romans. It's a canonical reading is what we're doing. We're reading the canon or the official list of scripture, and we're just trying to read Romans as Romans. We're not reading it systematically and bringing in everything that Paul has to say about salvation or about Jews and Gentiles into it. We're just trying to allow it to speak as clearly as we can. And that will be flawed and all those sorts of things, which is why we can continue to preach and think and reflect and read and meditate upon Romans, because there's always more there for us. But I hope that makes some sense of how those two things are connected. They are, but Paul's focus is less important, is less focused on a personal salvation and far more on the inclusion of the people of God. Would the Gentiles have understood all the Old Testament references? Why would Paul use so many if they wouldn't have? It's a good question. As I said at the outset, I think it was Ben Witherington in his commentary pointed out that of the undisputed Pauline letters, I think there's 13 of them, maybe not. But of the undisputed letters of Paul, that there are no debates about whether or not he actually wrote them. And there are a few. 31% of all of Paul's Old Testament quotations, I believe, are found here in chapters 9 through 11. So it's very clear that whatever else Paul was doing, he was really trying to build a case from the Old Testament, which of course suggests that his primary audience, as he's thinking about the Roman church, is probably the Jewish believers, for the simple reason that, as the question implies, the Jewish believers were more likely to be familiar with these stories. They would have recognized, the stories of Abraham and of Isaac, because those were the stories of the patriarchs, the fathers of the nation, so to speak. They would have been familiar with the reference to Pharaoh. They would have been familiar with the scene at the with the golden calf. They would have been familiar with some of the passages that Paul referred to, pointing ahead out of Hosea and whatnot. I do wonder how well even the Jewish believers would have known scriptures. They may have been in synagogue for most of their lives, and they may have heard many of these readings. And there are, of course, some passages that would have been more familiar to them than others. Their parents probably taught them, the basic stories and reflected on the stories. But it's unlikely that most of them grew up with a Bible in their house. So books were really super expensive, unlikely to have been very common. So there might have been small selections of texts that were collected together, and maybe someone could actually read and could afford a small papyrus scroll of certain teachings or whatever the case might be. So I often find myself wondering whether the Jewish believers would have really appreciated some of Paul's relatively nuanced understandings of Isaiah, for instance, where he quotes passages that are not, at least to my mind, particularly common in terms of reflections there. However, they would have been more likely than the Gentile believers, who would have been raised on, Plato and Aristotle and, Plutarch and, a bunch of the great Greek and Roman writers of their days, right? That they would have been raised on those texts, if any at all. So the question does remain, why does Paul utilize so many references? And I think that there are a few reasons why. I do think it's likely that Paul here is addressing the Jewish believers. Right, that he is, you think about it, the Jewish believers may have been the ones, like Paul, who felt most deeply the anguish of their people rejecting the promised Messiah. You know, as a Gentile, I suppose I could say, yeah, it's a sad thing, but like they're not my people per se, right? I'm not part of the Jewish nation. And so the concerns of the Jewish nation are not really my concerns, never really have been. So I can imagine that Paul is addressing a really felt need in the Jewish Christian community in Rome. I also think that Paul is seeking to undermine the Jewish tendency, at least in the Roman church, it seems, to put greater stock in their heritage than they ought, right? I suggested that they were taking those benefits and making them hurdles for the Gentiles to have to jump over. Like, you have to be like me in order to be a Christian. And Paul, I think, wants to hold both the idea that, yes, there's something really quite special and unique about the people of Israel in terms of the role that they play in salvation history, but that their entry into the people of God has never been about their ethnic background or about their adherence to the law or about their the temple worship or about any of those things. It's ultimately been about the mercy of God, right? That's what he wants to draw their attention to. So I think that's fairly important. And so I think he is reminding them of the benefits that they have while kind of subverting those and placing them where they ought to sit, which is under the mercies of God, which then invites them to not use those benefits as a set of hurdles for the Gentiles, but actually as something that they can share with the Gentiles, right? That they can share with them, that they can, you know, tell the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they can tell the stories of the Exodus, that they can recount and explain the text of Isaiah, and that they can talk about Hosea and why that's such a significant book. Like, all of those sorts of things, I think, are an invitation for them. I think for the Gentile listeners, Paul's use of Old Testament scriptures would have served two purposes. So Judaism in the Roman world was quite unique in lots of ways. And some of the things that set Judaism apart might be a little bit unexpected to us. So, for instance, some of the things I suppose we would expect to be seen as a little bit unusual. So their observance of the Sabbath, for instance, or their food regulations, right? The things that they could and couldn't eat, did and didn't eat. Circumcision was kind of a well-known distinctive of the Jewish people, not necessarily seen as that odd, but certainly unique to them. And those would have been fairly commonly known about the Jews, along with, as you can imagine, as a minority group that people thought were a bit strange, they probably were misrepresented in lots of ways as well. There were also, however, some things that were quite unusual about them, and that includes that they didn't have any idols. In other words, they didn't have any physical representations of their God. They were forbidden from doing that. And their God was invisible, right? So their temples looked very, very, their temple, because they only had one, that was another strange thing. There was only sacrifices held there, and there were, again, no idols there. And so that really set Jewish people apart. However, as odd as Judaism might have appeared in the Roman Empire, there was a certain degree of respect for the Mosaic traditions because they were so ancient. We love things that are new. Things that are new and updated are always better than things that are old. But in the ancient world, there was a suspicion around new things, particularly around these sorts of new ideas. So a new religion like Christianity was a little bit tricky to kind of sell, shall I say it, to the Romans. Because it was this kind of a strange religious innovation, whereas things that were ancient and venerable had with them a certain degree of respect. So the fact that Paul references the ancient texts of the Hebrew people, I think would have served the Gentile believers quite well, reminding them of, yeah, this is an ancient religion. There's a substantial and significant amount of background to this. We're part of something much, much bigger. And I think the second reason why Paul may have done this is related to that. He's reminding the Gentile believers, not just that Judaism is an ancient religion, but that Christianity, which has come from it, right? The, as Paul would see it, the natural outcome and conclusion of Judaism, that's their story too. And I think it's where we come back to the question of how the Jews and Gentiles got along. If the Jews were treating their benefits as hurdles for the Gentiles to jump over, I think it would have been easy for the Gentiles to begin to despise all of the so-called benefits of the Jews, right? Which were just kind of being used as a stick. To kind of beat them up over how they were or weren't living. But if those benefits are no longer seen as hurdles, as they're no longer used as a stick, but are in fact something that ought to be shared, it's easier for the Gentiles to say, this is part of my story as well. So I don't know, is the answer to the question, how well the Gentiles would have understood the Old Testament references. But I think that Paul's use of them was both aimed at the Jews, but also at the Gentiles, to remind them of the big, big story that they're a part of, to remind them of what God had done and the ways in which God had worked in the past that laid the foundation for how he was working now, right? So, you know, if God chose his people by his mercy and election in the past, then he's doing that now today as well. And that becomes the basis for their community of faith. So I hope that's helpful. Pretty kind of technical questions this week, which is fine. Looking forward this week, looking at the next section. I think it's chapters 9, verse 30 to the end of chapter 10. A bunch more Old Testament references. Paul continues to develop the argument. Looking forward to sharing that with you on Sunday, whether you're online or on site, and to the big three again next week. So thanks for listening, and hope you can join me again next week. And until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too. Thank you.